includes the total content of mind at large, but something more than and above all something different from the carefully selected utilitarian material which our narrowed individual minds regard as a complete or at least sufficient picture of reality. The brain is provided with a number of enzyme systems which serve to coordinate its workings. Some of these enzymes regulate the supply of glucose to the brain cells. Mescaline inhibits the production of these enzymes and thus lowers the amount of glucose available to an organ that is in constant need of sugar. When mescaline reduces the brain's normal ration of sugar, what happens? Too few cases have been observed, and therefore a comprehensive answer cannot yet be given. But what happens to the majority of the few who have taken mescaline under supervision can be summarized as follows. 1. The ability to remember and to think straight is little, if at all, reduced. Listening to the recordings of my conversation under the influence of the drug, I cannot discover that I was then any stupider than I am at ordinary times. 2. Visual impressions are greatly intensified, and the eye recovers some of the perceptual innocence of childhood, when the sensum was not immediately and automatically subordinated to the concept. Interest in space is diminished, and interest in time falls almost to zero. 3. Though the intellect remains unimpaired, and though perception is enormously improved, the will suffers a profound change for the worse. The mescaline taker sees no reason for doing anything in particular, and finds most of the causes for which at ordinary times he was prepared to act and suffer profoundly uninteresting. He can't be bothered with them, for the good reason that he has better things to think about. 4. These better things may be experienced, as I experience them, out there or in here, or in both worlds, the inner and the outer, simultaneously or successively. That they are better seems to be self-evident to all mescaline takers, who come to the drug with a sound liver and an untroubled mind. These effects of mescaline are the sort of effects you could expect to follow the administration of a drug having the power to impair the efficiency of the cerebral reducing valve. When the brain runs out of sugar, the undernourished ego grows weak, can't be bothered to undertake the necessary chores, and loses all interest in those spatial and temporal relationships which mean so much to an organism bent on getting on in the world. As mind at large seeps past the no longer watertight valve, all kinds of biologically useless things start to happen. In some cases, there may be extrasensory perceptions. Other persons discover a world of visionary beauty. To others, again, is revealed the glory, the infinite value and meaningfulness of naked existence, of the given, unconceptualized event. In the final stage of egolessness, there is an obscure knowledge that all is in all. That all is actually each. This is as near, I take it, as a finite mind can ever come to perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. In this context, how significant is the enormous heightening under mescaline of the perception of color? For certain animals, it is biologically very important to be able to distinguish certain hues. But beyond the limits of their utilitarian spectrum, most creatures are completely colorblind. Bees, for example, spend most of their time deflowering the fresh virgins of the spring. But as von Frisch has shown, they can recognize only a very few colors. Man's highly developed color sense is a biological luxury. inestimably precious to him as an intellectual and spiritual being, but unnecessary to his survival as an animal. To judge by the adjectives which Homer puts into their mouths, the heroes of the Trojan War hardly excelled the bees in their capacity to distinguish colors. In this respect, at least, mankind's advance has been prodigious. Mescaline raises all colors to a higher power and makes the percipient aware of innumerable fine shades of difference, to which, at ordinary times, he is completely blind. It would seem that for mind at large, the so-called secondary characters of things are primary. Unlike Locke, it evidently feels that colors are more important, better worth attending to, than masses, positions, and dimensions. Like mescaline takers, many mystics perceive supernaturally brilliant colors, not only with the inward eye, but even in the objective world around them. Similar reports are made by psychics and sensitives. There are certain mediums to whom the mescaline taker's brief revelation is a matter during long periods of daily and hourly experience. From this long but indispensable excursion into the realms of theory, we may now return to the miraculous facts. 4 bamboo chair legs in the middle of a room. Like Wordsworth's daffodils, they brought all manner of wealth, the gift beyond price of a new direct insight into the very nature of things, together with a more modest treasure of understanding in the field, especially of the arts. A rose is a rose is a rose. But these chair legs, were Saint Michael and all angels. 4 or 5 hours after the event, when the effects of a cerebral sugar shortage were wearing off, I was taken for a little tour of the city, which included a visit toward sundown to what is modestly claimed to be the world's biggest drugstore. At the back of the WBDS, among the toys, the greeting cards, and the comics, stood a row, surprisingly enough, of art books. I picked up the first volume that came to hand. It was on Van Gogh, and the picture at which the book opened was the chair, that astounding portrait of a Ding an sich, which the mad painter saw with a kind of adoring terror and tried to render on his canvas. But it was a task to which the power even of genius proved wholly inadequate. The chair Van Gogh had seen was obviously the same in essence as the chair I had seen. But, though incomparably more real than the chairs of ordinary perception, the chair in his picture remained no more than an unusually expressive symbol of the fact. The fact had been manifested suchness. This was only an emblem. Such emblems are sources of true knowledge about the nature of things, and this true knowledge may serve to prepare the mind which accepts it for immediate insights on its own account. But that is all. However expressive, symbols can never be the things they stand for. It would be interesting in this context to make a study of the works of art available to the great knowers of suchness. What sort of pictures did Eckhart look at? What sculptures and paintings played a part in the religious experience of St. John of the Cross, of Hakuin, of Hui Neng, of William Law? The questions are beyond my power to answer, but I strongly suspect that most of the great knowers of suchness paid very little attention to art, some refusing to have anything to do with it at all, others being content with what a critical eye would regard as second-rate or even tenth-rate works. To a person whose transfigured and transfiguring mind can see the all in every this, the first-rateness or tenth-rateness of even a religious painting will be a matter of the most sovereign indifference. Art, I suppose, is only for beginners. or else for those resolute dead-enders who have made up their minds to be content with the ersatz of suchness, with symbols rather than with what they signify, with the elegantly composed recipe in lieu of actual dinner.
Side 2.
I returned the Van Gogh to its rack and picked up the volume standing next to it. It was a book on Botticelli. I turned the pages. The Birth of Venus, never one of my favorites. Mars and Venus, that loveliness so passionately denounced by poor Ruskin at the height of his long-drawn sexual tragedy. The marvelously rich and intricate calumny of Apelles, and then a somewhat less familiar and not very good picture, Judith. My attention was arrested, and I gazed in fascination, not at the pale neurotic heroine or her attendant, not at the victim's hairy head or the vernal landscape in the background, but at the purplish silk of Judith's pleated bodice and long, wind-blown skirts. This was something I had seen before, seen that very morning between the flowers and the furniture, when I looked down by chance and went on passionately staring by choice at my own crossed legs. Those folds in the trousers, what a labyrinth of endlessly significant complexity! And the texture of the gray flannel, how rich, how deeply, mysteriously sumptuous! And here they were again, in Botticelli's picture. Civilized human beings wear clothes. Therefore there can be no portraiture, no mythological or historical storytelling without representations of folded textiles. But though it may account for the origins, mere tailoring can never explain the luxuriant development of drapery as a major theme of all the plastic arts. Artists, it is obvious, have always loved drapery for its own sake, or rather for their own. When you paint or carve drapery, you are painting or carving forms which, for all practical purposes, are non-representational. The kind of unconditioned forms on which artists, even in the most naturalistic tradition, like to let themselves go. In the average Madonna or Apostle, the strictly human, fully representational element accounts for about 10% of the whole. All the rest consists of many colored variations on the inexhaustible theme of crumpled wool or linen. And these non-representational nine-tenths of a Madonna or an Apostle may be just as important qualitatively as they are in quantity. Very often they set the tone of the whole work of art. They state the key in which the theme is being rendered. They express the mood, the temperament, the attitude to life of the artist. Stoical serenity reveals itself in the smooth surfaces, the broad, untortured folds of Piero's draperies. Torn between fact and wish, between cynicism and idealism, Bernini tempers the all but caricatural verisimilitude of his faces with enormous sartorial abstractions, which are the embodiment, in stone or bronze, of the everlasting commonplaces of rhetoric. The heroism, the holiness, the sublimity to which mankind perpetually aspires, for the most part, in vain. And here are El Greco's disquietingly visceral skirts and mantles. Here are the sharp, twisting, flame-like